Bitcoin presents an opportunity to live a permissionless life and to be able to interact in the world completely censorship resistant, and to use your money the way you want to use it and to not have it confiscated. And, you know, I really encourage people to think about what that means.
Hello, everyone. I'm John Chenow, and welcome to episode 8 of the Bitcoin Path podcast. This is a show where we have deeper conversations about Bitcoin and self-sovereignty, about how this new magic internet money is changing the world and changing ourselves at the same time. Joining me today is EconoAlchemist. EconoAlchemist is a solid Bitcoiner who has made some excellent contributions on his website, EconoAlchemist.com, with a focus on self-custody, censorship resistance, and building a non-KYC Bitcoin on-ramp. You can follow him on Twitter at EconoAlchemist and check out more of his work there. In this show, we have a really insightful conversation. We talk about what inspired him to focus so much on Bitcoin self-custody and censorship resistance, why it's so important to him, and what he thinks about coin joining KYC Bitcoin. We talk about why he's an avid user and proponent of Samurai Wallet, and we kind of outline the process of self-custody for a new coiner. This is an excellent resource for people who are somewhat new to the space and want to take this stuff seriously. EconoAlchemist does an amazing job at outlining exactly why it is so important, helping us to think through that process. I also ask him about some of the recommendations that he would have for someone who's moving into more of a mobile lifestyle to secure their Bitcoin. So with that, let's get into this conversation with EconoAlchemist. EconoAlchemist, welcome to the Bitcoin Path, man.
Thanks, John.
I'm really happy to have you on. I really appreciated your articles, well, the ones that I was able to dig into, just the amount of detail that you've gone into in terms of like outlining the entire process and really breaking it down and to very easy to follow steps of how to go through this in order to secure your Bitcoin properly. And just to go through the best practices, and even I really liked your the key storage point where you're firing these washers, right, and seeing like how they'd stand up to fire and everything like that. So
yeah, with the oxyacetylene torch,
right,
yeah. Yeah, man, I just really like showing people how easy self-custody can be and trying to help people understand that there doesn't need to be any fear involved with it. And, you know, I've written a couple pieces that are up on my blog, and, you know, I've tried to highlight some of the reasons why self-custody is important and how, even though you're taking that radical responsibility and that ultimate responsibility, and that there's no third party to fall back on, that's still better than the alternatives. It's better than having someone else holding on to your Bitcoin for you. So, yeah, you know, there's some really cool products out there. And I should probably say, you know, I'm not endorsed or paid by any of the companies or products that I'll be talking about tonight. I just do my own thing, and I like to share my opinions about the tools that I use, and you know, I like to show people that they can self-custody too, and it's not scary.
Yeah, 100%. And I am, just for the record, not sponsored by anyone, so there's no, you know, paid shilling or anything like that going on here. I'm coming at this thing just to give you a little context for me. You know, I've been involved with Bitcoin really heavily for the last year, but owned, I guess, for longer, but just, you know, and self-custody for longer, but just on like mobile wallets and stuff like that. So
sure.
It's really during this cycle is where I've taken things a lot more seriously and tried to really find out what are the best practices. How can I really secure my future? Because I do see this as something that is going to last for generations, and you know, it's going to be truly generational wealth. It's something that I want to secure for my own future and for my daughter's future and everything like that. So
sure. Yeah.
And I was, the reason that I hit you up, it's kind of a funny story. I was in California and I met up with a bunch of other Bitcoiners at the OC Bitcoin network.
Oh, and, nice.
Yeah, with like Brian and
yeah.
some of these other guys. And we had a great time talking. But at the end of it, I was almost overwhelmed with the gravity of, holy shit, like I am holding this thing that is so valuable. Like, and I want to secure it properly, but there are so many other, like, so many risks that are coming into my mind of like, well, what if this happens? And what if this happens? And, so I'm like, I gotta talk to this guy, kind of like sort this out. And maybe other people are in the same situation, you know?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think that's something we all experience as we learn about Bitcoin and the power of censorship resistance and the power of permissionless money. You know, it's definitely a marathon. It's not a sprint. And you just got to keep chipping away at it little by little and learn a little bit more every day. You know, like I had my first day dealing with Bitcoin and trying to figure this stuff out. You know, I've only been into this since December of 2018. So,
okay.
You know, I am by no means an expert, and I don't want any of your viewers to think that I'm speaking from a place of authority. I'm not. I'm learning this stuff as I go, and mm-hmm. I'm trying to share what I learn and what's worked for me. And, you know, like you mentioned, you're always thinking about the risks and what could go wrong. And I think that's really healthy to be thinking about your adversaries and be thinking about what the pitfalls are and how you can protect yourself against that. And you hear a lot of buzzwords like, you know, I didn't get into Bitcoin because it was censorship resistant money. I didn't really understand what that meant at first. I got into Bitcoin because I had a little bit of money and I wanted to turn it into a lot of money. And I think right. that's what a lot of people get attracted to Bitcoin for. But as I started learning about it, I realized what censorship resistance meant. And then I was able to reflect back on my life and think about times when my paycheck was getting garnished. And it made me think about, well, what would a scenario like that look like with censorship resistant money? Mm-hmm. You know, it made me think about times when, you know, I've had loved ones in my life that have substance abuse issues and they have been robbed at gunpoint. I myself have been robbed at gunpoint twice. And thinking about what life would have been like had I been using internet services and had I not been exposed face to face to somebody out on the street, what that looks like. And the fact that the reason I didn't know what that looked like is because when you deal with a bank and third parties, you're subject to their permission to use your own money. And so I didn't understand what permissionless money meant at first, but after I got into Bitcoin for the upside price potential and then learned about really what censorship resistant money looked and felt like and what permissionless money looked and felt like. And then I was able to look back on my life and say, yeah, you know, that would have helped me a lot in some situations. That would have helped some loved ones in some situations. There's a lot of power behind that. And then once I figured out how powerful that was, I quit caring about the price. The price is like, I've done a complete 180 since I started my journey into Bitcoin. I would rather have the price of Bitcoin trading at $100 and be able to do whatever the fuck I want with my money and not have to ask anyone permission for it than have Bitcoin trading at $1 million and have to ask PayPal for permission to spend my money and to spend it with vendors that they deem appropriate or make donations to political causes that they approve of. So, you know, I think if we lose that censorship resistant component, then it's the greatest revolution that never happened. What's the point in being a millionaire if you can't spend your money the way you want to spend it? I'd rather live life humble and free than be some millionaire in a cage. But, you know, that's just my take. And again, I'm no expert. Like, I'm just some long haired dude on the internet. Like,
I'm with you, man. Dude, I 100% agree. And I do see some institutional guys. It's kind of interesting to watch now some of the institutional guys coming in, and it's such a completely different world that it's going to be just fascinating to watch, like, how these companies start interacting with this asset. And, you know, I like CK came out with this little article that he did called the sovereign company thesis. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether these companies are able to self-custody in ways that are able, where they're able to establish their own sovereignty and just kind of step out of the system that they're really tied into. Like, if you're a Michael Saylor, for instance, like, you're an owner of a publicly traded company, like, it's almost like it's the golden handcuffs. Like, you don't have the freedom to do whatever you want. But I don't know, I guess, and that's not really what I want to focus on, because neither of us are Michael Saylor. But, you know, we're free individuals now who have the power to acquire Bitcoin and to custody it ourselves and to have complete control of it. And that's just an amazing thing that I'm so grateful for. And I really did not comprehend the full ramifications of that when I first came into it. So,
right.
Yeah, I'm really excited, man.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have that in common. You know, they get attracted to Bitcoin for the price action, and they stay for the censorship resistance piece of it.
Right.
And then, you know, and then they start learning about the pitfalls of KYC, and they start going down the privacy path. And, you know, I think that's great. And I'm an advocate for that.
Yeah, for sure. So, to kind of get us started, what kind of went over your inspiration for kind of going in this direction? I have a lot of questions, and so I sent the questions over to you. If you think there's some kind of like order and particular way in which to approach this, I'm really happy to hear it. I do have, you know, my particular situation that I'd like to open up a little bit about and kind of get your input on. Sure. But I'm definitely open to hear what you think. One of the questions I asked was about KYC, right? Like, most people right now are buying Bitcoin on these KYC exchanges. So they're taking them off if they're hodling. And, you know, that's kind of where a lot of the information stops. Like, once that happens, it's up to you what you want to do with them. Are you going to Are you going to coin join? Are you going to just like put them on a hardware wallet and, you know, secure them the best you can that way, and not worry about people, the exchange getting hacked or the IRS, you know, tracking and just knowing at all times how much money you have and which coins you actually own and that kind of thing. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah, you know, I think it goes back to thinking about your adversaries and what your risks are. You know, like, it's great that people are taking their Bitcoin off of the exchange and doing self-custody. So mm-hmm. now they've secured that censorship-resistant, permissionless piece of it, because now nobody can stop them from transacting the way they want to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the piece of that they've brought into their lives now is that there's an exchange out there that knows who they are and has their picture on file and has that associated with their Bitcoin address. And, you know, there's a reason the IRS put a $600,000 bounty up for anyone who could crack Monero, but didn't offer any bounty for anyone who could crack Bitcoin. They've already got that game dialed in and figured out. Like, they don't need any more help there, you know? So like that should be like a major red flag for anybody who's purchased their money through a KYC exchange. Like, they've got that game figured out. And, you know, I might be skipping ahead a little bit, but I know one of your questions was like, what I think about mixing KYC funds,
right?
And you know, that's, it really depends on what the user is trying to accomplish. You know, if you have KYC Bitcoin and you're trying to get some forward looking anonymity and blend into a crowd and break those deterministic links back to the source of your KYC funds, then yeah, you know, mixing can be useful. You can run your coins through Whirlpool and then you could spend them with a vendor and not worry about that vendor being able to look back and track all your transaction history before you spent with them. So it's good in the sense if you're looking for forward-looking privacy. But if you have KYC coins and you want to run them through Whirlpool because you think that it's going to erase the fact that you purchased KYC Bitcoin, you're dead wrong. Like, there's no amount of mixing that's going to erase the fact that you bought X amount of Bitcoin on Y date. And so if your goal is to make sure that the government can't track you down and try and enforce a 6102 order on you, or try and enforce a one-time, what do they call it? Unrealized capital gains tax, or, you know, some sort of tax on your Bitcoin holdings. Like, dude, I don't think mixing KYC coins is going to release you of that responsibility. Sure, technically they can't necessarily prove that you own specific UTXOs anymore. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you can't necessarily prove that you don't own them either. But they know that you bought X amount on Y date. So does ownership really need to be proved at that point? Like, I don't know. But if anybody's looking to get away from enforced government responsibilities for owning Bitcoin, my opinion is that the Bitcoin needs to go back out the way that it came in. So if you buy Bitcoin on Coinbase or you buy Bitcoin on Kraken, and now you're starting to consider the government as an adversary and thinking about a 6102 order or thinking about potential unrealized capital gains and thinking about how you can get yourself out from underneath those responsibilities, then you need to provably sell the Bitcoin, because you provably bought it, and that's why they would come after you in the first place. So if you want to get out from that responsibility, you need to go back onto Coinbase or go back onto Kraken and provably sell your Bitcoin, and then take that money, get on BISC, and then buy it non-KYC, and then keep your KYC and your non-KYC stacks completely separate. That's my opinion, because if you provably sell that Bitcoin and anyone wants to approach you and talk about it, you have something to go back on and be like, look, dude, I got rid of that Bitcoin. I sold it on this date and I sold this much of it. I'm not saying do it all at once, but, you know, I think people should try and build that pathway to go from their KYC stack back out the way they came in, and then get on BISC, buy non-KYC, and start a new stack of non-KYC coins. And once you have that path established, then you can just start doing it slowly and in small increments. You don't have to like sell all your Bitcoin at once and try and undo everything you've been doing for the last however many years. You know, but I think it's about making those small steps and establishing that pathway to a non-KYC stack. And then once you have that link made, just slowly moving your funds over. And then after you buy the coins on BISC, then run them through Whirlpool. And now you're blended into a crowd. You've got your anonymity. You've got your privacy because it's not tied to KYC. You provably sold your KYC coins. And I think in that scenario, you have a much better chance at fending off any adversary, whether it be government or whatever you're trying to do, whatever your goals are. But, you know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about it because I have those concerns, and that's what I've come up with.
Yeah, I see. That's really kind of where my mind was going, I guess, because I was hearing all this conversation about Whirlpool and how, you know, securing the path from like KYC to Whirlpool to cold storage, and I was just like, well, they still know that you bought that. Mm-hmm. If you're worried about that type of thing, like a nefarious state actor or people, you know, whoever might get control of that database and want to extort you for your money, then they're still going to know that you bought it that time. So I think that pathway does make a lot of sense. As far as buying non-KYC Bitcoin, BISC to you is probably one of the better options.
Yeah, BISC is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you heard of Azteco? Or yep. Experimented with them at all?
Yeah. You know, it was only recently 6102 Bitcoin said something about Azteco vouchers. I think when they had an announcement about like 720 million users are now gaining access to Azteco Bitcoin vouchers.
Yeah.
And when I saw that, then I kind of dug into it a little bit and really, really liked what I saw.
Yeah. It looks like a really cool project. The thing that, it's funny because when you're first coming into the space, I'm looking at, and I was thinking, I did think a little bit about KYC, and I was like, oh, well, it's more of a pain in the ass to go through some other weird exchange and you pay a premium and this kind of thing for non-KYC. But, and so I went just like the easy way, but but in reality, if you think about like the actual costs that are involved or the risks that are involved in owning KYC Bitcoin, the premium doesn't say it's a 5% premium or something. It doesn't seem to be all that bad.
Yeah, I mean, and with BISC too, keep in mind, like, a lot of times you can buy below market price. Like, you don't have to take the sell offers that are on there. You can set your own buy offer and wait for sellers to come to you. So there is potential to get below market value get below like the spot trading price.
Right.
You know, I'm going to be doing a thread/article soon on mining at home for earning KYC free Bitcoin.
Nice.
Yeah. So I just got my ASIC ordered and it'll be shipping hopefully this week. And that should be coming up soon.
Nice, dude. Looking forward to that. Yeah, mining is something that I'm really interested in too. I bought a couple just ant miners, like S9s, just to like mess around with it.
Nice.
And what I was trying to do is, this is a side topic completely to what we're going to talk about. But as an aside, I was looking at an option to run a generator on recycled oil, like black diesel, basically.
Sure,
yeah. And I was like, oh man, yeah, if I could get like all this black diesel from all these mechanics and run it through a centrifuge so that it just like burns really easily, then I could get like free fuel and run some ASICs on it. So that's a project that's on it's an iron on the fire, I suppose.
Yeah.
But a little bit of hobby stuff. So getting into now, we're on BISC, we get our non KYC coin and we run it through Whirlpool. So that's one step that I'd like to talk about. So you are kind of preferring Samurai over Wasabi, or do you have any kind of like preference? Do you have a reason, like kind of thought process around there?
Yeah, I definitely have a preference for Samurai and over Wasabi. I don't really have anything good to say about Wasabi, so I'm just going to focus on the positive things I have to say about Samurai. So with Samurai and Whirlpool, there's no address reuse. The Whirlpool transactions break the deterministic links. And their community members on Telegram are amazing. That, like, you can get on there and ask them any question. There's a bunch of people with experience and know-how that are just more than happy to help you out. More than a handful of times I've stayed up until like midnight and these guys are on Telegram with me, helping me work through issues, getting my dojo up and running. They're just an awesome team. The community is really great. And their software does what it purports to do. It works. Mm-hmm. My experiences with Samurai have been really positive and I have nothing but good things to say about everything that they've got going on. I put together a pretty detailed thread on, I tried to cover like the whole gambit of tools that they have. The developments they've done recently with Soroban and the post-mix spending tools are just freaking incredible. Their stuff works and people should use it.
Great. So in order to optimize that usage, is it really something to where you need a full node running and so you have complete control, or is it something you could do on a desktop and just kind of like
I think ideally you would want to run the Ronin Dojo and pair that with your Samurai wallet installed on your Android device.
Okay. Is the Ronin Dojo something that you can download on, or something that you can run on a Raspberry Pi yourself, mm-hmm. or do you need to buy it from them?
Hardware? Like here, I can show you my, I've got mine sitting right behind me. Nice. So like, I got a Raspberry Pi right here. It's in a little Nintendo case. Mm-hmm. And so that's my Bitcoin full node. So that's my Dojo. And then this desktop is running the Ronin user interface and the Whirlpool GUI. And then I've got this like little tiny monitor. Interface with it. So you want to have like a Raspberry Pi or like a Rock Pro 64, and then you can run your Bitcoin full node, your Dojo, on that single computer, and then you use the desktop to run the Ronin interface that you can use to manage your Dojo, and you know there's a bunch of really cool features on the Ronin UI, and then you can also run your Whirlpool graphical user interface on the desktop. And when you do that and you have that all paired with your Android device running your instance of Samurai wallet, then you're not sharing your Xpubs with anybody. So you're like achieving the most like privacy enhanced way to run this stuff. And what else was I going to say? When you have it all paired together, the Whirlpool GUI is just constantly running on your desktop. Whereas like if you try and run Whirlpool on your Android device, you got to keep that connected and open in order for it to continually mix. But when you're running it on your desktop, you can just leave that running and go to the store, go to work, go on vacation, whatever, and it'll just sit here and keep cycling. Mm-hmm. So like anytime you put Bitcoin into Whirlpool, you pay a small fee based on which pool you go into. And then your UTXOs can continually cycle into more and more Whirlpool transactions for free without having to pay any more fees. So the longer you can leave your UTXOs in there mixing, the more anonymity you're gaining and the more you're blending into the crowd.
Right, right. So in terms of, say you're going to transfer your main stack into cold storage, or one question that I would have, kind of go blurry every once in a while here, but just as a noob coming to the space, so you have your coins in your Samurai in the Whirlpool, why would you want to move those onto a hardware wallet? What makes it more secure moving it onto a hardware wallet?
Yeah, it's user preference. It depends on what you're trying to do and what your goals are. You know, a lot of people don't use hardware wallets and they just leave their funds like in Samurai wallet, for example, and that's totally cool. Other people, you know, someone might have a desire to use cold storage because if they use Cold Card, for example, you can use it in a way where your private key never gets exposed to a network connected machine. And that's what attracted me to Cold Card in the first place. Before I was using Cold Card, I was using KeepKey. Do you remember those?
KeepKey?
Yeah. I don't have anything good to say about Keep Keys. but when I, you know, when I heard about hardware wallets, the, you know, one of the ideas was like, it's called cold storage because it's air gapped and it's not connected to a computer, and your private key is never exposed to a network connected device when it's in cold storage. And I was like, well, that's really cool. I don't fully understand that, but I like the idea. And so I started looking into it, and, you know, I saw Trezor and I saw Ledger. And the first thing that jumped out at me was that you had to plug them into a computer. And I was like, well, what kind of cold storage is this? And then I found ColdCard, and honestly, like, it was pretty intimidating at first. Like, I didn't know what was what, and it had all these cool features, but, you know, even though I was a little intimidated by it, and it seemed like Ledger or Trezor was more user-friendly, I just had to understand what was going on with ColdCard. So I just kept reading the webpage and reading about the features until it sunk in. And once it clicked, I was like, holy shit, this thing is, I got to try this thing. So yeah, I bought a ColdCard, and once I started like using it, like, you know, just like everything else with Bitcoin, as soon as you do it once or twice, all that fear kind of melts away and it clicks. And you understand it and you see the potential in it. But yeah, I like cold cards because you can use them air gapped. You never have to connect it to a computer. And you know that private key has never been exposed. Potentially, you know, unless you like write it down in a book and leave it in your living room for all your guests to peruse. But
right. Right. Yeah, and so it's just the fact that the device has not been connected to the internet gives you that sense, that security, or that that assurance, right? Whereas if you're generating a wallet, you're generating your private keys on your normal laptop, there's always the potential that there could be malware, or there could be, and it's connected to the internet, it could be some kind of like exposure of that information.
Yeah,
or potentially record of that information.
Yeah, that's the thing, you don't know, you're trusting, and it's all, this is a game of minimizing trust, so you can do that by using a device that's never connected to the internet, and you have a much better guarantee that any of those potential pitfalls of generating private keys or interacting with private keys on a network connected device are mitigated.
Right. So I've been kind of having this conversation back and forth with my brother a little bit, because he's newly getting into the space, and he recognizes the need for self-custody and everything. And he's been researching hardware wallets. And, you know, I sent him a couple of videos of just kind of introductory videos, but the more like he would research these wallets, and he's like, oh, well, this one's like made in China, and they have this like legal disclosure saying like they don't have liability or something, and if you have to like sue the company for, or like you're ultimately trusting this Chinese company, or you're trusting this other like a Swiss company, and it's like, well, man, you can't like get around that. And so the ColdCard was an interesting option, but it's just going to take a little bit more of a process, right, to go through in order to use it correctly, I guess.
Yeah, it's definitely a marathon, not a sprint.
Right.
But yeah, you know, with the cold card, like, you know, you can use like some, you can make your process a little bit easier by generating transactions with like Blue Wallet. You can import your XPub from your cold card to Blue Wallet. And, you know, keep in mind when you're doing that, that is a potential privacy concern. But once that's imported, you can monitor the balance of your cold card, and you can use Blue Wallet to generate a partially signed Bitcoin transaction. You can transfer that to the micro SD card, put that in the cold card, sign off on it, and then transfer it from the micro SD card back to your iPhone. Mm-hmm. And then load that partially or that signed transaction into Blue Wallet and broadcast it. You could sign a transaction with your cold card and broadcast it on your Bitcoin Core node. You can do it with Electrum. So, you know, there's a bunch of options for doing it. But yeah, there is an extra step where you're like building a transaction and then giving it to your cold card to sign off on it, and then putting it back on your network connected device to broadcast it.
Right.
But it's a really cool process. Like, especially if you like take the time to build your own node and you broadcast your own transaction from your own node, like, it's really cool the first time you do that.
Yeah. 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 I had a Raspberry Blitz node up and running for a while, and started trying to get the Lightning, mess with the Lightning stuff a little bit. And I was trying to open up a BTC Pay server channel on it, but and somehow it fucked it all up and it stopped, like, stopped working. And I tried like just wiping everything clean and reinstalling everything, but then it keeps getting hung up on this one process. So I think an SD card I might need to just use a completely new SD card or something like that. But yeah, I'm excited to experiment with some other options as well.
Yeah. I tried loading a BTC Pay server on my Raspberry Pi node. And I got it like running, but it just like bogged everything down. And again, I'm not a programmer. I'm not a coder. Like, I probably fucked it all up from the get-go. But I kind of stumbled through it and got it working, but it just really bogged everything down, and I ended up uninstalling it. But
right.
But yeah, I've got another like desktop computer. I want to load it with Linux and put BTC Pay server on it, and you know, I'd like to learn about that. I'm curious. So
nice.
I learn best by hands-on experience. And
yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's what's so cool about this space to me is like, I have no technical or programming experience at all, but here I am. I've downloaded, I'm running Ubuntu on all my on both of my main machines now. And, you know, I've downloaded a lot of open source software on them. And I'm just like incrementally growing a little bit of my knowledge and like building a Raspberry Pi computer. Like, I'd never considered myself able to do something like that, but
yeah.
But it's cool to, you know, just go through the process of learning. It takes a long time though.
Yeah,
it does. Make all these mistakes and yeah.
I mean, that's how you learn, trial and error. I mean, dude, it like when I first tried building my first Raspberry Pi node, dude, it was a solid 2 months. Like, I worked on it every day. it took me 2 months to stumble through all that stuff. And like,
yeah,
I had no fucking idea what I was doing. And like, having a good guide was difficult to come by. So I was just like piecemealing all these different resources from different people. And And I was trying to run Bitcoin Core QT because I bought like a small monitor to go with that Raspberry Pi. So I wanted that user interface. Mm-hmm. And I was having a hard time finding anyone who had ran, usually they just run Bitcoin D and they run it headless with the Raspberry Pi. But I wanted the user interface on my Raspberry Pi. And so I had a bunch of trouble trying to piece the stuff together. But like, I found some good resources and like finally got it up and running, and it was a lot of work, but it was totally worth it. I learned a lot.
Yeah, man. Yeah, that's what this is all about. And I'd love to, what it reminds me of is, it makes me think of your name, Econo Alchemist. And I'd love to hear kind of your inspiration for why you are the Econo Alchemist. Because when I think of alchemy and the alchemists, they're, you know, working with the incorruptible substance and they're trying to refine the materials and into its purest form, and they are becoming pure themselves and they are being refined. And it's really what I see in a lot of Bitcoiners.
Yeah.
The more I meet them and the more I work with it myself, to be honest, like it's doing some crazy shit.
You know, to be perfectly honest, the story behind that name is not deep at all. There's like the meaning of it is so like surface level. But you know, where I've gone since I put that name together, yeah, you know, I'd like to think about that it kind of aligns with some of those like deeper meanings that you were describing. But the true story is that a couple years ago, I was talking to some coworkers and I was talking about Seyfeddin Amous and his book, The Bitcoin Standard. And I was trying to tell them that he was an economist, but I kept stumbling on the word economist. I couldn't pronounce it. And it kind of came out sounding like a Econo Alchemist. And they were like, is that who this guy is? He's an Econo Alchemist. And we were just laughing our asses off. Like, you definitely would have had to have been there. But that's all it was. It's like I was trying to say the word economist and I kept stumbling over my words. And so that name, Econo Alchemist, like it just kind of stuck with me and resonated with me for some reason. And so I made it my Twitter handle.
Yeah, man. That's 100% better than than, you know, anything else. Because, if I picture myself thinking like, oh, Econo Alchemist. I'm an alchemist in the economy. Yeah. Just like this self-important, I don't know.
Yeah, it was just a total mishap, but
yeah,
it stuck for some reason.
That's cool, man. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
So I'd like to get back to this self-custody idea, and maybe I'd like to get your input on a couple things. So one is, what are some main things that people need to think about? I know you have a list of like materials for securing private key backups. And what exactly is going on? So we are taking, if we're using the cold card, we're generating a transaction, loading the information onto the cold card with an SD card. And then the transaction is happening on that device. And then we are bringing the information back to our laptop to broadcast that information.
So when you build a transaction with like Blue Wallet or Electrum,
mm-hmm.
and you hand that transaction off to your cold card, your cold card is just signing off on all the information in that transaction. It's saying, yeah, I have the private key to spend this Bitcoin from this address.
Gotcha.
And it verifies that it has the private keys to do that.
Right.
So once that transaction is signed, then you can broadcast it. You can take a signed transaction and, you know, there's even these, there's this site called Mule Tools, and there's a funny article in there about sending Bitcoin via carrier pigeon, because they take a signed transaction and like put it on the pit, or you can put it on a pigeon and have that pigeon go deliver it to someone who has a network connected device, and they could broadcast your transaction for you. But there's, you know, that all kind of goes into that theme of censorship resistance and permissionless spending. Like, you know, as long as you can build that signed transaction and get it to somebody who has a network connected device, they can broadcast it for you. But back to your original question.
I'm definitely going to have carrier pigeons in my Citadel to broadcast all. There would be no internet connection, no NSA spying at all.
Yeah.
We'll speak direct. I'll be tweeting purely through carrier pigeons.
It's a pretty cool concept. I like that thought exercise. But yeah, so the cold card is just signing off on that transaction. The transaction is not happening on the cold card. You're just signing off on the transaction. It's just verifying and allowing the Bitcoin in that address to get spent. When you take the seed words of your cold card and stamp them into some metal washers or onto a plate, you are creating a robust way to ensure that if you ever had to restore that wallet, you don't, or you can worry less about fire and flood and other like environmental hazards that could destroy your backup if it were written on paper or some other method. So like, you know, the private key is represented in human readable format as 24 words. And those 24 words represent a very long and unique number, which is your private key. If you lose your cold card or somebody steals it or whatever, and you had a bunch of money on it or a bunch of Bitcoin on it that you wanted to gain access to again, you could use your backup and those 24 words to recreate that wallet on another device, another cold card, or you could, you know, use any of these other wallets. And then you are restoring that wallet and regaining access to those Bitcoin funds. So that's all the backup, the metal backups are for. Because right. You know, a lot, you're always told, like, don't ever type your seed words into a computer. Don't ever take a picture of them. Don't ever store them on a computer. Don't digitize them. So you're oftentimes encouraged to write them down on pad and paper. And that's great. But what happens if there's a fire in your house and that gets burned up and your cold card melts? How do you restore that wallet? Or what happens if there's a flood and that paper gets destroyed? That's why the metal backups are becoming popular, because they can, you know, as I demonstrated, they can survive extreme temperatures. You know, when I heated up those washers with that oxyacetylene torch, you can expose them to very harsh environmental conditions and they can still be readable, and they can still give you enough information to restore your wallet even after being exposed to those conditions. So they, you know, they just survive a lot better than paper. And there's a ton of people doing a bunch of creative methods for metal backups. And I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah. So one of the things that I you know, as just a newer person coming into this, I was thinking, so you have your private keys. I guess the whole like mental barrier that I'm trying to get around is like, what are the things that I need to secure and protect and make sure no one has access to at all? And it's, I guess, all of it, like the coal car itself, the SD cards that have, so because the seed phrase is also, is it stored on the SD card as well?
No, not by default.
Okay.
I don't even know if there's an option to export, or yeah, I don't even know if there is an option to export your seed phrase onto the SD card.
Right.
There might be, but I would definitely recommend not doing that. Right. Anytime you have your seed phrase in digital format, you're just opening yourself up to a whole nother level of risk.
Yeah, because it can be copied so easily and transmitted just without you even knowing or forgetting where it is.
So yeah, you know, like if I have a cold card and I keep it in a safe,
mm-hmm.
but I keep the seed phrase on a micro SD card that's not secured and someone grabs it, potentially they could restore my cold card wallet on another device or another software wallet and empty my cold card, even though my cold card never left the safe.
Right.
You know, there's some safety precautions. You know, one of them is that BIP39 passphrase or your quote unquote 25th word. So like if someone gets your 24 words, but they don't know what your passphrase is, then they're not going to be able to spend your funds. And that's why I put the recommendation in that tutorial where I'm demonstrating the washers and the metal backup. You know, I put a piece in there about generating a strong high entropy BIP39 passphrase to accompany your 24 seed words.
Okay.
And to make sure you have that backed up too.
So that passphrase it's not just an extra word that you remember. It's something that it's another phrase that you back up separately and you store that separately.
You can. Yeah. I mean, you got to kind of war game it and think about what your risks are, what you're trying to accomplish. You know, some people may want to keep their 24 word metal backup in one geographic location and keep the 25th word, the passphrase, in another geographical location. They may be okay with keeping them together. But yeah, it's just another safeguard to help increase the security of your Bitcoin.
Right. So say you were, that's really helpful. And I appreciate the outline. It really makes it a lot clearer for me. Especially, you know, thinking in terms of like what kind of setup that I want to go down. So one question I would have for you is say you were looking to move into more of a mobile lifestyle where you're not necessarily going to have one home base for the next like 6 months to a year. What are some things that you would think about and consider in that, like, because in this unpredictable world that many of us are living in, that like I think many of us Bitcoiners tend to be adversarial thinking, right? And one of the threat models, say, could be that you need to leave very quickly and you don't have time to necessarily secure everything, take everything with you, I guess. So Yeah, how do you think about that and being more of in more of a mobily friendly?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think a lot of people will be facing that. And, you know, I think a lot of the first thing I would think about is what happens if I lose my phone?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're completely dependent on that device to interact with the outside world, what happens when it disappears? Mm-hmm. Because it, you know, you got to think about it, it's only a matter of time before you get mugged in your travels, or you drop it in some water, or get, you know, whatever. So think about, what do you do when the phone is gone? And, you know, like the washers I used for that tutorial, you know, they're tiny. That whole washer stack is only like this big. So that is something you could easily keep on your person, in your backpack, or, you know, I don't know. I imagine if you're jumping from hostel to hostel, and you're not going to be stopping at a bank in every town and renting a safety deposit box to put it in. You're probably going to keep it in your pocket or in your backpack, but you know, you just got to think about what happens when that stuff is gone. Maybe you leave your backup, your metal backup, with a trusted family member, or you bury it in your parents' backyard, or I don't know.
Right. Yeah. No, that really helps. And I guess a question. So the cold card or any other hardware wallet can't be utilized without the private key, right? Or can the cold card itself, if someone has possession of that, I guess that's one question that I have, is what's the vulnerability of someone getting custody of your cold card but not having your private keys?
Yeah, so you don't need to have like a physical metal backup of your seed phrase to use your cold card. It's just recommended that you back up that seed phrase just in case.
Just something to happens. Restore it.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
So if you're just out and about with your cold card and someone steals your cold card, that's not necessarily the end of the world, because they need to know the PIN that you set to access your cold card. So you want to make sure that you set a really strong PIN to get into your cold card. The other really cool feature about cold card is that it has this feature where you can set up a duress wallet, so that, let's say you're out traveling, someone sees that you have a cold card and they know what it is, and they mug you, and they're holding you hostage, threatening your life until you open this cold card for them.
Mm-hmm.
It has a duress PIN feature where you can give them the PIN for that exact situation, and it'll open up a wallet that is different than your main wallet. So, like, let's say you set up a duress wallet with a quarter of a Bitcoin in it, and your real main wallet on your cold card has the rest of your Bitcoin in it. If anything happens and someone's trying to rob you and get you to force you to put that PIN number in, you can give them the duress wallet PIN number, and they'll see that there's some funds in there. And the hope is that they think that that is all that you have, and they take those funds and let you live to see another day.
Right.
And then you get to keep the rest of the funds you had in your main wallet.
Right.
Another cool feature is that it has a BrickMe PIN. So if you wanted to, like, if you were in that situation and you wanted to brick the device, you could give them another PIN number, and it would literally turn that piece of hardware into a brick. It would be rendered completely useless. And there's also a time lock feature on it where, like, after you enter your PIN number and it's correct, it'll start counting down. And you can set that to a pretty long period of time. I think you can do like 7 days.
Where it's locked, where no one can access it for a period of 7 days.
Yeah. So like,
okay.
For example, if you set it to 4 hours and you punch in your PIN number and it's correct, it'll display a clock and it'll start counting down, and it'll have to count down 4 hours before it opens and allows you to do anything with it. And it has to be connected to power that entire time. Okay. So yeah, if someone gets your cold card, man, like there's some pretty good safeguards in place to protect you in case it falls into the wrong hands. You know, Samurai Wallet has a PIN access lock on their wallet. So if someone gets to your Android phone and they see you have Samurai Wallet on there and they try to open it, they have to know your PIN code to open that wallet. So it's another safeguard in case you lose your phone or it falls into the wrong hands. A lot of wallets have PIN code options. So.
Right. Awesome. That's really helpful. I just think about like, well, if I'm carrying around this hardware wallet, it's another device or another thing to be concerned about. And is there, you know, a question that I've asked myself is like, is there a way to set up just a separate, set up a computer or set up a wallet that is secure enough to where I don't need to lug around a separate device, but that would take away the security of having a completely air gapped device. Right. So it's just a matter of like what you're comfortable with.
Yeah. It's all about trade-offs. You know, you just gotta think about your trade-offs and think about what you're trying to achieve. And dude, I mean, if I were going to go like backpack through Europe for a year, I probably wouldn't bring a hardware wallet with me. I would just have my Samurai wallet on my Android device or my Blue wallet on my iPhone. I would feel totally comfortable doing that.
Yeah, but, for sure.
You know, everyone has to like assess their situation and think about their worst case scenarios, hope for the best, and get out there and live a little.
Yeah, man. So one more question about that. So for your Samurai wallet, do you have private key storage or private key backups in metal for that as well? So pretty much any wallet that you have, you want to have like a hard metal copy of the private key.
Yeah. I think ideally, you know, like, so when I first started experimenting with different wallets, I started keeping a notebook. And so I have this notebook with like, dude, I don't know, 50, 60 different wallets in it.
Yeah.
And Cold Card came out with this, I did a thread on their BIP85 implementation. And what's cool about BIP85 is that you can generate the seed phrases or the private keys. You can generate more private keys for other wallets, and you will always be able to restore those private keys as long as you have your master private key.
Yeah.
So like, for example, I did a thread on using BIP85 to generate a 12-word seed phrase and then importing that seed phrase into Samurai Wallet. So what's cool about that setup is that now I have a Samurai Wallet on my Android device, and I don't have to necessarily punch those 12 words into metal to back them up. As long as I have the master seed phrase for my cold card, I can always just secure that one seed phrase, and I will always be able to regenerate the and restore any of the wallets derived from that master seed phrase.
Okay.
So you do it with an index number, and in your cold card, you go to derive entropy, and you put in an index number, say index number one, and it'll ask you, you know, do you want to make this like a 12-word phrase, an 18-word phrase, a 24-word phrase? And you select what kind of what format you want the private key to be generated in. And then you can use that to create in a wallet on another piece of software or, you know, whatever you want to do with that.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, any wallet you have that's a standalone wallet, you are going to want to have a backup of those seed words.
Yeah.
But the cool thing
that
about
simplifies it a lot, where yeah. you can have, you know, the master key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really helpful. That because the just the complexity, you know, the complexity of dealing with all these things or dealing with multiple different wallets and different private keys and remembering like how much is on each one, you know, because you want to kind of like, I don't know, do you feel, I guess we can get into this a little bit, like, do you feel that that's a good way to go to not have all of your Bitcoin in, or the vast majority of it in one particular wallet? Does it spread the risk of like having it in multiple places? Or I guess with the single cold card key, master key, it kind of makes it all under one anyways.
Well, you know, again, it's all about trade-offs and what the user is trying to accomplish. You know, I learned best through hands-on experience. And when I started figuring out wallets, like I wanted to try like all the wallets and multiple yeah. variations of those wallets. So yeah, I've got Bitcoin stashed in a bunch of different places. I have a larger portion of it in one place. It just depends on what you're trying to do with it. And, you know, there's trade-offs to each. If you have all your Bitcoin in one wallet and you lose that or it gets compromised, then all your Bitcoin's gone. If you have it spread out over 10 different wallets and you can only restore two or three of them for whatever reason, then, you know, you're kind of hosed there too. So,
yeah.
You know, it's about different trade-offs.
For sure.
And then what was the second part of your question?
Oh, well, I was wondering if you've thought about – oh, what were you
– You were saying there if you're using the master seed phrase on cold card with BIP85, it's all kind of under one anyways. I wanted to mention that what's cool about that is if one wallet gets compromised, it has no effect on any of the other wallets that were generated with that master seed phrase. You know, if your master seed phrase gets compromised, obviously that's a different problem. But if you right. generate 10 different wallets from your master seed phrase with BIP85 and one of them gets compromised, it has zero effect on any of the others.
Very cool.
Whereas like I've heard people bring up the point like, well, why wouldn't I just use the different BIP39 passphrases on the same 24 or 12 words? And the problem with that is if your 24 words or your 12 words is compromised, then the security of all your other funds in those wallets is only as good as that passphrase at that point. So you better hope you had really good high entropy passphrases set. Otherwise, they're going to pick off all those wallets one by one.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's huge, man. This helps so much. So have you thought about multi-signature as a potential option? I wonder if
you honestly, given that. Honestly, I find it very interesting. It's definitely on my radar, but I have not messed around with multi-signature. I haven't really had the need to explore it, and I'm just I'm pretty overwhelmed, like just trying to keep up with what I'm doing now. There's so much information out there to absorb. I'm definitely going to get there. Like the only multi-sig exposure I've had is through BISC, because you have to put some money in or you have to put some Bitcoin in escrow. But like, I don't really have to manage that on BISC. Like, it just kind of happens, and I put up my security deposit and then I get it back. So,
right.
I think multi-signature is cool. I think there's definitely some benefit to the possibility of using multi-signature wallets in different jurisdictions to help prevent a 6102 attack. 6102 Bitcoin mentions that from time to time, and I think that's a really interesting idea to help protect yourself against oppressive government. If it takes 3 of 5 signatures to move this Bitcoin, but one of the wallets is in the U.S., one is in Brazil, and one is in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, good luck trying to force that to happen.
Yeah.
So I think multi-signature is really cool. I'm definitely interested in it. I just haven't really even started exploring that, because it's like just this whole other thing.
Yeah, man. Fair enough. I think it's a journey, and one step at a time.
Yeah.
Like, we're kind of enjoy the ride. I like how I don't know, back in the day when Trace Mayer was still with us, I used to listen to the Bitcoin Knowledge podcast. That used to be like the only Bitcoin podcast that I would listen to, and I started listening to it in like 2016, way before I even owned any Bitcoin, just to like start learning about it. And then I listened to it periodically, but he would talk about, like, you know, if you have a certain amount of money, you put that amount of energy of security into it. And then when it grows to another amount, then, you know, you put more into it. So I think that's a healthy approach.
I think there's some validity to that. You know, you don't want to protect your $1 million house with a $25 lock, you know, or like,
yeah.
You don't want to keep a bar of gold like secured with a zip tie. So, you know, I think there's some validity to that. I just don't know like how important that is. Like, one of my rebuttals to that is like, you know, all of Satoshi's Bitcoin has been sitting in these addresses. You know, you got 50 Bitcoin from every block reward that he mined. It's been sitting in there. Those aren't in multi-signature, and they've been there for over a decade. Like, nobody's cracked that safe open. Like,
that's true.
I guess I just need to understand more about it to really formulate a good opinion. But personally, for me, I just haven't had the need.
For sure.
I feel really secure with the way I'm managing it now. So.
Yeah, man. Well, that's the important thing.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for your time, Econo Alchemist. This has been awesome.
Yeah, sure.
I think this is a really beneficial conversation, and I'm going to re-listen to it And it'll be a great resource for like anyone new to the space, you know, because I'm already getting questions like on Instagram saying like, hey, you're into this Bitcoin thing, right? And I got one girl text me this link. She's like, I just bought a Bitcoin course to like learn about it. And I'm like, what Bitcoin course did you buy? And she sent me this link to this random guy who's got like bitcoinrich.com or something. And I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah. There's going to be a lot of that, unfortunately. And, man, I wish people all the best, and I hope right. I hope they make their mistakes early and make them fast and learn from them as quickly as possible.
Yeah, man. Do you have any parting thoughts? Like anything else you'd like to share, even in a questions for me or anything like that?
You know, I guess one thing I'd like to say is that I hope people, I know that it's really exciting. You know, I mean, look at what happened today. Bitcoin's making a new all-time high. And I know that's really exciting for a lot of people. And it's really easy to think about how much US dollar or how much fiat currency you're going to be able to trade that Bitcoin for in the future. But I really encourage people to think about what they're trading the Bitcoin for. Fiat currency is broken. It has failed. It has created so much pain and misery in this world. And it has been weaponized to the point where people are living oppressed and going hungry and driving themselves insane. Bitcoin presents an opportunity to live a permissionless life and to be able to interact in the world completely censorship resistant and to use your money the way you want to use it and to not have it confiscated. And, you know, I really encourage people to think about what that means, because in my opinion, I think that the Federal Reserve should be abolished. I want to live to see the day that there is no US dollar Bitcoin index. I want Bitcoin to be the replacement. I want Bitcoin to be the currency that is getting used. And I encourage people to use their Bitcoin. Don't just hodl it. You can always get more Bitcoin. Use it, spend it, interact with it. You're going to learn from that experience. And it may be difficult for people to really understand the implications of having a money that cannot be confiscated and a money that is permissionless and a money that is censorship resistant, unless you have lived through some hardships where you've been put in a situation where you don't get to have the say and you don't get to have the choice. And you get censored, or your money gets confiscated without your permission, or you don't get permission to spend money the way you want to spend it, the way that you see fit. So, you know, I think it's important for people to really consider how much power lies in Bitcoin. And yeah, it's exciting to think about being a millionaire, but like I said at the beginning of the interview, what's the point in being that rich if you have to ask permission to spend that money? You know, I think people will be a lot better off living a humble life and living it freely. So just my thoughts.
Amen. Couldn't agree more. The true potential for fuck you money, and the ultimate fuck you money, like the fuck you, not just to like your friends who like didn't think you could make it, or the or to people you don't like or something like that, but to the true oppressive, like, force, evil force of our time. We have the ability to utilize this, and it truly is, you know, a weapon of at a grand scale, and I'm just amazed to be you know, to be learning about it and to be wielding its power. So I'm wholeheartedly with you, man, and this has been a great talk. I think that, like, with this great power comes great responsibility, of course, and you know, it's this will help me to be a lot more confident and to rest easier, just knowing that I can put together a good plan for proper self-custody and help others to do the same. So
awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation with the Econo Alchemist. I am so grateful for him coming on and talking with me. I honestly took a huge breath of fresh air after that conversation, and just was so much more, just had such a better understanding of what the path ahead looks like for my own strategy. And I hope that the same is for you, the same goes for you as well. So with that, until next time, may you live a meaningful life and enjoy your freedom as a sovereign individual.